What a day, what a day, what a day. My name is Ryan Hansen. Thank you for joining me on this episode of EQ Book Club. Today, I have an incredible mentor of mine. He has taught me a lot about the connection between mindfulness / emotional intelligence and business. I think what I've learned most from him is sustainability, not just sustainability in the socio-environmental context, but also creating a sustainable, long-term business lifestyle and mindset. Jeremy Kovas, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for the kind introduction, Ryan. I'm happy to be here. And if you hear a child screaming in the background, my apologies. I've got a five-month-old that's upstairs somewhere.
And if you're hearing some weird booming over here, I am near a SpaceX launch site. This is true. It's been very interesting. They've launched like 4 times in the past 2 days. So that could happen too.
Well, your noise is a lot cooler than mine.
So. All right. I wanted to talk to you about the thing I learned first and foremost from you, which is business and developing, designing businesses in a more conscious, sustainable mindset in ways that we can create longevity for the business as well as make these businesses impactful for humans and not just profit. Tell me a little bit more about what you teach.
Sure. So again, Ryan, thanks for having me today. I teach creative business leadership at the Savannah College of Art and Design. I've been there 5 years now. It's a field, honestly, that I didn't expect myself to be in is education, but I've truly, it's grown on me like crazy. I've got a background that wouldn't lead itself to being in education, but it's something I've become pretty passionate about.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that background and how that did lead to education.
Sure. So I studied political science as a undergrad, and I initially thought, like most kids, I guess, looking back on it, that I was going to go into politics or be a lawyer, go into that field. And it turns out it's one of those things that happen sometimes in life, and I think it actually happens to everybody, where you don't get what you want, right? I didn't get into the law schools I wanted to go to, and I decided to change and pivot my career path at that time. And it's one of those things that, looking back on it, I think I would have been absolutely miserable as a lawyer. There's nothing wrong with lawyers. I've got friends that are lawyers. It's just not for me. And at that time, I found a program in Atlanta at Georgia Tech, that combination of technology and international affairs. I got really involved in the group at Georgia Tech that builds solar-powered racing cars called the Solar Jackets at the time. It's called Georgia Tech
Solar
cool. Racing now. And I learned way more building those solar cars than I did in, honestly, the coursework sometimes. It was a interdisciplinary team of students that are engineers, scientists, and people like myself that have no background in engineering, building a car to race against other universities around the country and around the world. From there, I found out there was an MBA program at Tech, and I ended up getting a dual degree and was walking away from Georgia Tech to go into finance, leave the city of Atlanta and go move to New York or something. And one of the people that donated to our group, the Georgia Tech Solar Racing Group, I had met just randomly at a sustainability conference where I just talked my way into it. You know, it's all these executives, and this gentleman had built a new museum in Atlanta, and we'd kind of kept in touch for a few years. And I sent him an email, you know, goodbye, I'm leaving Atlanta, it was good to know you. And he actually emailed me back and pitched me the job of being the director of the Millennium Gate Museum in Atlanta instead of going into finance. And again, it's one of those weird things in life where you think that you're aiming towards one thing, and life sometimes tells you you should be going in another direction. So I took the job, man. We ran the museum and we really put on some amazing shows. We raised a lot of money. And the marquee show maybe was this Churchill exhibit where we found the only, Churchill was a prolific painter, and we found the only painting he created during World War II. And it's this just amazing story of him giving this painting called the Tower of Katubia Mosque to Franklin Delano Roosevelt at the Casablanca conference when they decided the timing of D-Day, and he gives him this painting to seal their friendship. It turns out this painting's lost for years, decades after FDR dies, and our museum finds the painting And lo and behold, it's owned by Brad Pitt, of all people.
Oh my
Right.
gosh.
So another one of these weird things that happened. And so we reached out to him and told him our thesis for this exhibition, that painting helped save Western civilization, and he was all about it. And he let us borrow the painting. Anyway, so we got a lot of press there. We
Wow.
got a lot of press for other things. And SCAD finds me out in the news. The latest thing that we did was we 3D printed the largest work of classical artwork ever made at that time, at least, the statue of Zeus, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, for the Olympics in Rio. And they reached out to me to teach, and it was an opportunity I thought that I would try. And here I am today, still teaching 5 years later. I didn't know it was going to be this long of a stop, but honestly, it's grown on me every year. And it's a testament, honestly, not to me or to SCAD, but to people like you, Ryan. That's why I'm still there, and that's why I'm doing this. I could leave and go do something else, anywhere, but I really enjoy learning about people like you and what you want to do, what your dreams and ambitions are, and helping you, at least showing you different resources and paths to accomplish that. Whether I'm successful or not is yet to be seen. The fact
I don't know about that. I think it's pretty clear that you were successful, at
that
least with me. I learned, most of the stuff I know about business from you, and now I'm running a successful business. So, I mean, A plus B equals C
Okay, well,
in this
I
situation.
appreciate it. I try. And so anyway, that lo and behold, I'm here at SCAD today. And what we teach is entrepreneurship in the arts. And we teach a project-based methodology called design thinking. Design thinking, in a nutshell, is essentially just understanding people. I mean, like, it's asking good questions. It's doing your diligence and going out. And if you come upon some time in your life, and this happens to everyone, I think, as well, you have an insight, a thought, right? That thought maybe grows, and you're like, oh my God, this could be a business, this could be something big, whatever, right? All design thinking is trying to build a method around how can I then take that idea and ask the right questions to determine whether this will really work out in the real world. Will people buy this business? Do I have the right resources, the right assets, the right skill set, the right people around me to make this happen? Maybe there are people are interested, but is there enough revenue for this thing to work? Trying to validate some assumptions that you might have about the idea before you go out and actually execute it. And it sounds very simple, right? And it's essentially just the scientific method. And the scientific method, if you remember from your seventh grade class, is just, I have an idea. How can I develop something just to test that idea to see if it's true or false, right? It's never going to be black and white in business. Never. It's never going to be, you're never going to get to the point where you have enough data, you've talked to enough people, or you've done enough research to be like, oh, this for sure is going to be the next, Airbnb. This is going to be the next Uber, right? Or whatever business idea it is. It's more so for you to reduce and eliminate risk, right? So you've got this idea, and I have the same problem. You've got an idea, and it is your baby. You want it to work, right? You don't want to hear negative things about it, but that is the path to wasting your time, wasting your money, because most business ideas just they don't work, and it's fine. That's why it's so hard to be an entrepreneur, because it's not just the fact that you're spending time and money, but you're putting your heart on the line, right? I mean, this is something you're probably telling your friends, your family, and if it doesn't work, you're kind of embarrassed too, right? I mean, you're out there and you're like, promoting this. If it doesn't work, then it's kind of a pride thing too. So we can talk more about design thinking. We could talk more about entrepreneurship. I'm happy to talk about both, but that's kind of like just a high level overview of what I do at SCAD.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that you brought that up because I definitely haven't shared this on the podcast, but this is my third iteration of my business, right? I mean, kind of, probably 12th, but of real, like, this is where I know I am right now. This is the third big iteration, big change of what my business looks like. And it wasn't until this third iteration that I'm actually finding success and not feeling embarrassed that I have a business or that, because it wasn't making any revenue before, and I was having a lot of trouble with X, Y, and Z. I didn't know how to do marketing. I didn't know really much about anything in the first iteration, which started when I had, like, before I even really met you. And then second iteration, I got a coaching certification and thought I knew what I was doing at that point. And then it turned out that that was just a nice to have, and it wasn't exactly what I cared about. So I was no longer passionate about it, and I wasn't really pursuing clients, and I wasn't really putting my heart on the line to try to make this business work. And now this iteration, I'm so clear on what I'm doing and how it works, and I've done testing, and I've gone through clients before in these previous iterations that it didn't work out because I didn't know exactly what I was doing. I didn't have I hadn't done all the testing, and now I'm at a point where I actually get to feel successful and proud of this business.
Totally.
And it's because of, like, doing the work and the iterations and something else you touched on, like being human focused and figuring out, okay, what do the people that I'm working with actually need? Is it this thing that I learned at a conference for a week, or is it something more specific that I have to teach that I know specifically that I am good at teaching or that I care about? Right.
Right. I mean, it's such an important point, Brian. I mean, you see entrepreneurs and you see them successful, but you don't hear or see the path leading up to that, right? You know, your podcast, as I have told you, is Peloton for the mind, right? Peloton, yeah. The gentleman that founded Peloton, I can't think of his name off the top of my head, but they failed all the way to success. That's pretty much his story. If you look him up, I think it's John Foley, maybe. Look him up and just pick one part of Peloton. You want to pick the logistics of bringing all of these different pieces together to actually build the device. If you want to pick things like recruiting the right engineers, if you want to pick something like fundraising, I mean, he went through a Rolodex of hundreds of people before he raised a dollar. I mean, like, he just failed all the way to success. At the beginning, I mean, he couldn't. People were like, you want to put an iPad on a bike, you know, like they didn't get it. It reminds me of something like I saw the other day. It was talking about, it was a video from Good Morning America in like the 90s. And they're like, internet, what is internet? You know, what is that at symbol at or whatever. Right. And it's connected to, I'm watching these things about cryptocurrency, Ethereum, blockchain. I feel really strongly that blockchain, not cryptocurrency, not like Bitcoin. We could talk about this at the end if you want or whatever. This is a different path, but
go ahead, get into it.
Blockchain. Blockchain is this technology that you've heard of, right? And so it's the technology behind cryptocurrency. And I feel very strongly that this decentralized nature of blockchain technology, this peer-to-peer network idea where you can remove, right now there's a lot of power in being an aggregator, being the Amazons of the world, being the Facebooks of the world, where you are the connector, you're the platform between two different parties. Blockchain technology eliminates the aggregator and connects those two parties directly. And so instead of value accumulating, whether that's value in dollars or value in data in the middle, that value is returned to either side of the platform. Cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, and Ethereum, these are just rewards for maintaining the network.
Sure.
Anyway, sorry, that was a different
thing. No. That's a really interesting connection to what we were talking about. And kind of the decentralization is talking about more of the human side, right? It's giving back to the community that's building, right? Instead of it being stuck somewhere in this place that we don't really see and turning into profit that we never get back, right?
Right. So that's a great point. So it's in practice, it's giving value to the creator. So in the news recently, I'm not sure how familiar you are with these things. They're called non-fungible tokens, NFTs.
Right.
And so NFTs are a function of what's called the Ethereum blockchain. If you've heard of Ethereum, maybe you've heard of ETH, which is like the value, the Bitcoin of Ethereum, if that makes sense, right. The cryptocurrency of Ethereum. Anyway, non-fungible tokens are a way to take digital assets, art, URLs, GIFs, movies, music, anything digital you can imagine.
Plays in basketball is what
NBA Top Shot. Yeah, for sure. So it's like NBA Top Shot is like baseball cards or basketball cards, physical. They're just digital. And so NFTs are a way to give that value to the creator instead of like a gallery or a centralized a merchant of some type. The cool thing, the famous one that just sold, Beeple's, it's called Everyday, for $69 million on these things. $69 million for a digital artwork that you, Ryan, can Google Beeple Everyday, and you can download the picture and you can have it on your computer. But somebody bought this for $69 million. They don't actually own the intellectual property to this either. So don't think that they own the copyright. So the question maybe that you would ask is like, what's the point? Like, why would somebody do this? Well, the thinking is, why does someone pay millions of dollars for a Beanie Baby? Why does someone pay millions of dollars for a stamp? Why does someone pay millions of dollars for a classic car? Why does someone pay millions of dollars for physical art? It's because of the emotional connection they have, because it makes them feel cool, because it makes them the center of attention at a party, and they can talk about, the BMW Roadster they just bought. When you buy a classic car, you don't get to own the intellectual property to the engine, to the design of the car, or whatever. It's kind of the same thinking, except you're buying digital assets. And so as we move more and more towards what's called a Web3 environment, where it's a very decentralized place, maybe something like the metaverse, which is like, if you've ever seen Ready Player One, it's a great movie. I recommend it. This online environment, these digital assets are going to be things that people collect and own and make them cool and give them good feelings about what they own. I don't know if it's in a bubble right now. I mean, it's kind of crazy, Ryan. Honestly, I can't justify $69 million for work of digital art, but I see the point, I guess. I mean, there's artists everywhere, from musicians that complain about the deals they have with studios. If there's a way to get around that, if there's a way to get around galleries, if there's a way to get it out there, get your creation out there, and not have to lose that commission, that, or lose your sales to some of that commission, I think that's a win. Also, real quick, I'll answer your other question. The Beeple
Go ahead.
thing is what's built into that on the Ethereum blockchain is that every time that artwork sells again, the original creator, his name's Beeple, Beeple gets a cut. So it was sold for $69 million. Whatever that is in Ethereum is actually how it was sold. But if it's sold again, let's say for $690 million, Beeple's going to get a percentage of that sale. So imagine if they had something like this for like Picasso or for Michelangelo, right? Or famous artists in the past whose works of art have sold multiple times, where the original creator is gaining revenue, gaining income from the sale of that over and over again. It's a neat feature.
Yeah, absolutely. And you connected that to music, and that's going to have me thinking for the rest of the week, without a doubt. I'm sure it would be to have a decentralized system that allows musicians to make money that actually allows them to live would just be incredible.
There's Kings of Leon, their newest album is going to be an NFT.
Wow. Cool. I will definitely look that up after this.
Yeah, check it out.
I'll put a link in the description for anybody listening too. Sounds awesome. Cool. Learned a lot. Wow. Thank you for contextualizing that for me. I think we all just kind of, if anybody's like me, you hear NFT, you hear blockchain, you hear all this stuff, and you kind of get the gist of it, but you don't understand the potential or the possibilities that come from it. And it sounds like there's a lot of really exciting human based. I knew it was based in trying to give power to the people, but that brings a lot of clarity to how that can be done, which is
Think
really cool.
about like think about Amazon for a minute. So Amazon, when they first started, right, they're Amazon 15 years ago, but they're trying to attract two groups, right? They're trying to attract us consumers to use Amazon's platform to buy things, but they're also trying to attract that other group, right? They need people to sell things on Amazon, and they need people to sell everything on Amazon, right? You can go to, I mean, I've never gone to Amazon and not been able to buy something.
Sure.
But now that Amazon is at the scale that it is, the relationship that Amazon has with merchants has changed from one of trying to attract them to one that's trying to compete with them, right? So if you ever go to like Amazon and you search for batteries or something, Amazon basic batteries, right? The Amazon basic, right. You know, shoelaces. Whereas before they would want vendors to come on and sell these things, but now they have the data. They see with the volume of sales and the frequency and all these things, right? They've been collecting this for years. They can see high volume, potentially commoditizable items and knock the merchants out because they can undersell them and they can rank that Amazon basic item at number one and then bump down the original merchant down the thing, you know, down the list. So the relationship has changed. The middle, the centralized figure here, Amazon, is taking value away from not just the merchant, right? Is put them out of business, but you as well, because they, after they put them out of business, can then increase the price, right? Because there's no competition. And Facebook's the same way. Facebook initially, you know, a centerpiece platform that's trying to attract people, your friends, family. You know, they went from a position of trying to gain users, right? More and more people to use their platform. Right. Just to sell them advertisements, to sell advertisements, that's their business model. So you'd watch ads on your Facebook feed. So now it's extracting data from you, right? So it's a free service monetarily, but it's not free for data, right? They are not just collecting data on when you log in, but they're collecting where you're logging in. They're collecting, what are you looking at? They're collecting, you know, the battery life on your phone, anything that they could get their hands on, because they have sophisticated programs, sophisticated algorithms that can correlate these things. And they're like, okay, well, the people that are using Facebook at 9 p.m. that have low battery life, well, maybe they are folks that we should not advertise loans to, because for whatever reason, people with low battery life that use Facebook at night, you know, they never pay back their loans or something. I don't know, right? Whatever it is. Weird correlations in the data. But they have now transferred from just trying to attract people to trying to be an aggregator of your information.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, I think this is a great transition from, we've talked about decentralization, this blockchain system that allows power back to the people. How do we create conscious businesses that are more physical and service-based businesses that are non-digital to allow them to focus more on the people and creating things that people want and need in a way that is serviceable and conscious and intentional?
So it's a big question. All right. And it's
a big question. Yeah.
And it kind of, you know, it depends on the type of business, whatever, you know, it's, I always have he came and talked to y'all's class. I think his name's Tom Todd. He's a lawyer and he's been practicing law for 40 years. And we always have a Q&A at the end where we get questions about, you know, I said to the class, ask him anything about law. And he always prefaces these things where, you know, here's the answer, but it depends, right? A very lawyer type thing to say, but it's true. For like answered questions like this, it depends is the real answer. I can tell you in broad terms that your best bet is to sit down as if you think you have an idea for a physical product or a store, sit down and just think about who are the buyers, who are the influencers, and try to identify them by not just demographic characteristics. Don't just say, you know, it's two white dudes here, two, you know, white males living in the Southern United States, whatever. Don't just do demographics. Try to think about their psychology. It's harder to do, and it's harder to understand the market through that lens, but you're better off by thinking about psychographic indicators more so than anything else. And so thinking about like, you know, what do they do on the weekends? What TV shows are they watching? But by the way, this is why Facebook's so powerful, is because you've put all that information in there for them to use and have.
Right.
And that's why their ads are so effective, is because they have all these psychographic things. But thinking about who...
And you keep saying Facebook, but also Instagram, it's the same company. That's when you're scrolling through Instagram.
TikTok, whatever, any social media platform that's free.
Right. Either way, you're hitting the ads, and 90% of the time that I'm seeing an ad now, I'm clicking it. I'm saying, all right, I'll check out the website.
So that's a great point. I'm not saying ads are bad by any means.
Right.
They are just getting smarter. And so, like TikTok, for example, they don't claim they're a social media company. They claim they're an artificial intelligence company.
That's one of my favorite pieces of information that you've ever told me.
And they're great too. And it's a Chinese company. And of course, they had political issues a year ago, which I guess those all went away. Anyway, your best bet is whether it's a physical product, a store, a restaurant, whatever, is try to understand your customer, thinking about them in psychographic terms, and literally going out. And there's a tentativeness in entrepreneurs to be afraid initially of sharing their idea because they think someone will steal it. That is not going to happen.
No, I have recently been thinking about that. If you barely have the will to do the work, no one else does either.
And there's no one like you that has all the pieces in your head. And most of the time, Ryan, and you could probably attest to this, is that it's execution and
Absolutely.
it's not just the idea. There's ideas are a dime a dozen. And the execution of the idea is really where the value is. Anyway, so going out and talking to who you think those customers are, you're not asking them, would you buy this? Would you do this? You're so more so like just trying to get a sense of their day, you know, like how would this plug in? Like what needs do they have? Like what problems do they have in their life that maybe your product or service can fulfill? You know, it's harder to do when you're doing things like, let's say I wanted to open up a, Ryan knows this, I like kimchi, which is a Korean dish. If I wanted to open up a Korean kimchi stand in Piedmont Park here in Atlanta, you know, it's hard to go out and be like, hey, would you buy this kimchi, you know, or whatever. Because it's kind of like there's an art esque aspect to it being food, but you're still better off no matter what the situation is, talking to them and just understanding who they are and what they're currently doing, how your idea could fit into their life.
A specific example based on that, if you're going around and maybe you go to another Asian dining facility, right? And you're asking the people there, why are you here today? And what you might come to, if you can ask the right questions and get there, you might realize the psychological aspect that they are fulfilling in this, even though maybe your demographic data is that they're white, they're not, they're this age, that age, whatever it is, psychographical information that you start receiving is that they just love trying new food, or they love trying food that is not what they might call American food. And then you've discovered, all right, this is kind of the psychological space that I'm looking to sell my product to.
Right. And it doesn't always have to be just psychographics too. You can ask them, how frequently do you eat here? You know, how much money are you spending per meal? Are you buying an alcoholic drink with your meal every time? Right. Because the margins, of course, are going to be have reliant maybe in some of these restaurants on alcohol. So it can be business questions as well, but the main points I'm trying to convey is trying to take that baby, take that idea, and just trying to do it without doing any diligence about who you think your customer is, what are the main assumptions that you have with this business model about how you would make money, about what requirements you need personally, whether that's, you know, honestly, simple things. Do you have the time? If you're a family, do you have time to do this? Would you quit your job to do this? What are the funding needs of this? Another major mistake sometimes made by entrepreneurs is thinking they can just go out and raise money, and like, it just does not work like that, especially for businesses that are called lifestyle businesses that are like, you know, you're talking like not a huge amount of revenue. Investors in general that are not like your family and friends are looking for a large return, like 20x, 15x return on their money in a reasonable amount of time. They can take their money and get 10% just by buying the S&P 500 stock market. They ain't looking for 10%. They're looking for much more than that. You know, it's not something that many think about, but most likely you're going to be funding this yourself. It's the brutal truth. And honestly, sometimes, I just wouldn't say sometimes, I'd say most of the time, you actually don't even want to pursue financing of any type until you have like traction of some sort. Whether that's you, it doesn't have to always be money. It could be users or something. But the more traction you have, the more likely you'll receive a more favorable valuation of your business. and terms if you actually do go the financing, the fundraising route.
Well, let's go back to something we were just talking about, and this is going to be another big question, but a huge thing that I've learned from you is the ability to ask meaningful questions. It is an incredible skill to have. Like, being able to ask questions is such a huge skill in any context, whether that's teamwork or partnership or creating a business, running a business, working in any environment. Asking questions is going to help you. Being skilled in asking questions personally allows me to be intentional with the things I do, the words that I say, and the choices I make on a daily and long-term basis. Asking questions is also a skill that allows me to successfully engage my guests in podcasts, in my podcasts. I don't come into these episodes with questions on the table. I know what you like to talk about, and we start a conversation, and then I start asking questions from there. And they turn out well because I know how to engage you in these questions that hopefully my audience will care about. It's also what makes me a good coach, and it's the reason I believe I am a good designer of systems, strategies, and canvases that help people ask questions to themselves. We already talk a lot about the necessity of curiosity on this podcast, but and here's the big difficult question: why do you think asking Or this isn't it, but the one after this will be. Why do you think asking questions is a top priority skill these days?
You know, it's when you were talking, it reminded me the great innovators of the world. One of the few things that they all have in common is that they're all really curious people, like you mentioned. Where does that come from? Is that a lot of them, most of them had a lot of hobbies, and it is everything from music to, you know, gardening to something online to reading to whatever, playing a sport. They were constantly learning new things. They were not afraid to dabble. They were not afraid to be a dilettante, and, you know, meaning that, like, you know, I work at one of the best art and design universities in the country, but I won't ever claim that I am an expert in art history or knowing everything about industrial design, right? But I do know some things about both of those fields. And if you engage me at a cocktail party, I could talk to you about Matisse, or I could talk to you about Tesla, or, you know, Tesla's recent Model S or whatever. It doesn't mean that I'd be an expert, and it's also kind of tangentially related to, you know, another important point I hope, Ryan, you received is that ultimately relationships and connections should be a major focus of your life, and
Yeah, huge.
relationships ultimately make life worth living, whether that's family or professional or both, right? And how do you build those? It's through these things, through dabbling, through trying new things. And that could be like travel. And traveling doesn't have to be to Afghanistan. It doesn't have to be a long ways away. Travel could be a new neighborhood in your city. Traveling could be a different city in your state. It could be going out into the woods and just wandering. I can't emphasize enough that you should be spending a few hours of your week just getting away and stop looking at a screen and just wander away. Let your mind do its thing. It seems like I remember, you know, I don't know. I mean, you used to be bored. You don't have the ability to be bored anymore, because you're
The
the
luxury of
luxury
being
of being
bored.
bored, right? Whether you're busy with work or life, or if you find a few minutes, you're immediately looking at your phone. And there's no bottom to the internet. There's no bottom to Instagram, right? And so you could scroll forever. Having that freedom, that flexibility to just go. Your brain needs a break, and it's got to have that time to make the connections that occur when you are out there playing basketball, and the next day, you know, you're practicing drawing or something. I don't know, right? Two completely different things. And you'd be surprised about how strong and how resilient and amazing your brain is if you just let it do its thing. And so sometimes doing nothing is actually what you should be doing, is absolutely nothing, or something completely opposite of the field you're in. I wish I could say that I'm a world-class expert at one thing, but I think that more so I know a good deal about a lot of different things. And it helps me personally, my job, because I have students like you, Ryan, or former students, very successful alumni now, that go into, your field, teaching conscious business, this podcast. I've had other students in completely different fields, from dance to solar panels to nonprofits to entrepreneurship to working for consulting businesses. And what I think has provided that foundation of being able to engage is the ability to have the strength and the practice. And it takes time just to be able to walk into a library and feel comfortable in any section of the library, whether it's science, philosophy, fiction, whatever,
Comic books.
comic books. That is, it's, if there's one thing you leave here today with, I really recommend pick up a hobby. It doesn't have to be forever. Just try it. And if it doesn't work, try something else. And then let your brain relax and just go for a walk. Ryan and I were talking about the art form of just wandering. Just wander. That's one of the best things you could do for yourself.
It really is. And I like your, it wasn't even a metaphor going into the library and feeling comfortable in any section, but it also is a metaphor, if you want it to be, for just being able to talk to anybody and get on their level, right? Get on, I'm not saying that their level is above or below you, but their level is different than your level. Their interests are different than your interests. But the more you know about more things and the more you can take the steps away to make those connections of why those things connect, then you find yourself being so much more successful. And from your story at the very beginning of the episode, all of your situation changes came from having connections with other people or gaining connections because of those connections. And political science didn't go into solar cars, and solar cars didn't go into teaching at an arts and design school, but the museum, right? And then the arts and design school teaching business at an arts and design school, which is even more interesting. But it's because you are able to learn and have that curiosity and create those connections between all these things, and those are how you've gotten here
And
today.
listen, right? I mean, and listen, you continue the metaphor. One of the things I learned a long time ago that it was really stuck with me. I don't remember who said it or where I read it or whatever, but you want to be able to come by easily what others have spent their entire life trying to figure out, right? So,
I love that.
so that's why reading and looking widely is so important, because you're absorbing the wisdom of someone's lifetime, right? Whether that's reading a book for a weekend or whatever it is, a podcast, it doesn't always have to be reading, right? Whatever that medium is, you are, if you have an open mind and can listen, you're taking in all the hard work that that person has done in a short period of time. And small steps like that don't overtly seem like they add up. It's not like I can say, okay, go to the bookstore, and if you buy, these 12 books, you're going to be the wisest person, the smartest person, the most coolest person, or whatever. It doesn't really work like that. And each interpretation is different about when you read things or whatever, but it does add up over time. And it's ultimately, if you ever want to try to be innovative, you don't read books about how to be innovative. All you got to do is just read widely. I love watching animal documentaries. I love watching space documentaries. Neither of these things have anything to do with business. But I can tell you the insights from both of those I've applied.
Yeah, I actually, this is a really good transition as well. But before I do this transition, I've actually gotten a lot of my friends on Curiosity Stream because of you. It's such a great
Sure.
platform for just all sorts of learning and information and being curious. But I once stayed after class with you to ask you if you had any specific book suggestions for me. My original question was that, or my comment was that I wanted to get better at asking questions. And that's what I told you. And you said, all right, let me think on it. And you sent me an email a couple of days later with these book suggestions. But what was great about these book suggestions, I asked specifically for books that would help me be better at asking questions. And you didn't send me a single one. But they really did, because of exactly what you're talking about right now. One of the books was Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, and Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. These kind of ancient philosophical texts and thoughts about the world, and them asking questions to themselves, and me being able to read their processing of these questions. And then Some by David Eagleman, one of my favorite books of all time.
Yeah, it's a short little book, isn't it? It's not long.
No, it's real easy. I mean, I think I read it in like an hour because it was just so good. I just picked it up and I was like, oh my gosh, I got to finish this right now. It's amazing. But it's 40 stories about what could happen in the afterlife. And the reason that book exists is because he started asking himself the question, what could happen in the afterlife? And he came up with 40 four-page stories about the afterlife that are all hilarious and interesting and just really think about. Yeah, it's a really fun book. But, you know, along those lines, you sent me 12 books. I purchased them all on ThriftBooks, and I have read probably 10 of them. And none of them are about asking questions, but they have all allowed me to be better at asking questions because I have all this new context for this and that, and, you know, understanding the way other people think and new ways to think about things and making those connections like you were talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of like I don't know how you would call it, like base knowledge. And so, you know, reading like core books in philosophy, reading core books in science. I sometimes regret that I have to require business books in my classes. I teach business, right? But so I do, you know, I try to put the real books in there too, because a business textbook ain't going to teach you anything. And what you're going to do is you're going to give it away. You're going to throw it in the trash at the end of the year. So I try not to require those things, but the books you're talking about, you know, they're not business books, but they're books about how to think. And I'm not trying to, when I recommended those to you, Ryan, I hope you got this, to say Taoism or Stoicism are philosophies that, you know, you should follow. They're just books that have impacted my life personally. Those two in particular are two of my favorites, but they're fundamental ideas that have stood the test of time. And as you know, I start most of my classes, every class, with a quote. You know, I'm a big fan of like condensing wisdom down to its simplest form as it could get. And both of those books are no longer than 100 pages. And the Tao Te Ching is 1,200 or 2,200 years old. I think Aurelius' book, Meditations, might be 2,000 years old too.
I think somewhere between 16 and 2,000, yeah.
How many things have you ever read that are 2,000 years old, right? I mean, how many things could possibly, think about what you read today, anything you've ever read. Will it really be around in the year 4,021? You know, what is that book today that's been written? So yeah, I'm not sure if that was a question, but like
I didn't get to the question yet, but I forgot to get to that. But yes, an excellent contextualization of that information. The question I was getting to is that more difficult question that I was talking about earlier. How might people get better at asking questions if they don't want to read some ancient philosophical text?
How do you get better at asking questions without reading ancient philosophical texts?
You could take out the second part of that question, but
it's
kind of the idea.
Asking questions, I think that you've got to be a good question asker to be a good citizen in this country.
Excellent point.
You've got to be a good question asker sometimes to be a good husband or wife, I think. It's not really just about, you know, asking questions for the sake of asking. It's more like constantly improving yourself. You know, if you always just take everything that, you know, comes at you, and it's so hard now with all this disinformation coming through social media, you just take it in, and you don't question your assumptions about a topic or about your life as it currently is, whether you're happy in your situation or unhappy or whatever, whatever it is personally or professionally, I think that you should take a step back and think about yourself, think about your life. You know, it's such a funny thing to ask, because you hear quite, here's what you should do is you should act like an 8-year-old. That's how you become a better question asker. Parents get annoyed because their children are like, mom, dad, why is the sky blue? Mom, dad, why, is the bird flying? Mom, dad, why can't I have a cookie for dinner? Mom, dad, why can't I have ice cream for breakfast? They're constantly asking questions because the world is new to them. Yeah. I would encourage you to just forget everything you know and begin again. That would be, if you don't want to read ancient philosophy, then you need to eliminate, take a step back on whatever thing you are pursuing, business, personal, whatever. It's your life. Take some time to think about it. Try to look at it with new eyes. That's what I would recommend, I guess, if you don't want to read ancient philosophy, which I totally get. Maybe although those two books that Ryan recommended, they don't take long to read. They're pretty good.
No, not at all. I actually really, the way I read Meditations is it's kind of blocks. It's chunks of information, chunks of thoughts from him, right? So I just...
That wasn't meant to be published, by the way. So imagine if Ryan, your journal was published in the future.
Exactly.
That's all it is.
That's literally what it is. And so I just kind of acted like I was reading somebody else's journal. I just threw it on the kitchen table, and every day at breakfast, I would sit there and I would read a chunk, and they're so easy. And if you think about it, I've talked about how to think about reading before, but especially a book like this, if you just throw it on the table and you think, all right, I'm going to read one of these chunks, they're like paragraphs they're mostly like paragraphs to three paragraphs. And you say, during each meal, I'm going to read one of these. Well, you read one and you're like, hey, I'm not done eating. I really want to read more. Like, this is really good. So then you start doing it. Suddenly you're done with it in a week, when if you had actually just done one at a time, it would have taken you a couple months. Yeah. But the point is, if you can chunk things down and make them easier for yourselves and start having a mindset that you can do anything if you take those small steps, this is kind of outside of what we've been talking about today, but doing that is extremely helpful for getting anything done, whether it's reading a book or starting a business. I mean, that was honestly the hardest part of starting a business, is thinking that you need to be somewhere that you literally can't be yet until you've taken the small steps to get there.
You're right. I mean, it's hard to do, and I struggle with it as well, but anything that you want to accomplish, you have big ideas, whatever it is, but if you can just get in the habit of taking whatever the smallest step is, it doesn't have to be 5 minutes. It could be like, all right, I'm just going to read 1 minute every day. And everybody has a minute sometime. I'm going to read a book for 1 minute every day this week. Whatever the smallest amount is, I'm going to, walk around my house or whatever, my neighborhood, for 10 minutes every day. It doesn't have to be a lot. It's just like the smallest amount, for sure, is the way to go.
And you'll find yourself inherently, that's how you create autonomy. And then competence, because you've done it a little bit. And the more competence you create, the longer you're able to do it, the more interest you're going to have in doing it, because you have more autonomy over it and you have more connectedness to the thing that you're doing.
Well, it's not so overwhelming as well, right? I mean, it's just the smallest step is it's easier to form habits that way.
Well, I think that was a great way to sort of wrap this up. And we were just talking about books anyway. So do you have 1 to 3 to 10 to 20 book recommendations for us?
Sure. So first one is along the Stoic line, Letters from a Stoic by Seneca. Seneca was the advisor to Nero, who was one of the worst emperors of Rome ever. And Seneca was one of these folks that's a really good person. And he's actually killed by Nero for betraying him, but he never did. Nero was just a crazy person. Some of these crazy stories you hear from the previous dude that was in charge of this country and the advisors trying to keep our country together, and the terrible, tough position that they were put in because of the childlike nature of the previous president.
Cool. I've got a couple friends who are really good at
Okay. So
Tlaloc.
anyway, Letters from a Stoic Seneca, Life 3.0 is really good. Max Tegmark. And this is about the next two book recommendations are about artificial intelligence, because I think along with blockchain, these two ideas, these two technologies, are really going to transform the way that we live, and there's going to be a lot of innovation because of these two things. So Life 3.0, Max Tegmark, and then there's another great book by Kai-Fu Lee, and I think it's called Silicon Valley, China, and Artificial Intelligence. That is not just AI, but what is happening in the competition between the United States. And I tell you what, it is the best book I've read about what's really happening in China today, about the growth of that country's economic power and how the understanding that Americans, the stereotype Americans might have that Chinese businesses are just copying US businesses has not been the case. Was in the past for sure, but they have moved on from there. And there's some real interesting ideas, innovation, specifically around AI that is occurring in that country. Anyway, those three books would be pretty high on my list, I think.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Listeners, as always, you can find these suggestions, prior episodes, recommendations, and a list of my 5-star favorites at bookshop.org/shop/EQ. Please use this link to support the podcast and shop local. As per usual, if anything in this episode clicked with you, let me know, let your friends know. If you think you have some work to do in understanding yourself or learning how to ask questions and understanding the systems that drive the external factors of your life, but more importantly, the internal systems of your life, go to my website at agsage.com. That's agsage.com. Or click the Work with Ryan button in the link in my Instagram at EQ Book Club. It will take you to schedule a call with me where we will just chat about what's going on in your life and see if we will be a good partnership. It's non-committal and I won't even talk money. I just want to see if I can help you. And if I can't, I will try to send you in the direction of someone or something that will. It's a great day for a day, y'all. I love you. Goodbye.